welcome to A Thunder Perfect Mood. I am your host, Marie Moon, and you are listening here on WMFO Medford 91.5. We continue with our Summer of Prince. Last week, we skipped across the surface of the protégés and the collaborators, and we spoke a bit about Prince's very early life in Minneapolis. His high school years spent single-mindedly pursuing and deepening his musical virtuosity, up until when he graduated, saved up some cash, and made a demo at Moonsound. This week's episode centers on the years between when he finished this demo and when he really hit his stride as Prince. 1977, 1978, 1979. These are the years when Prince was somewhat insecure. He knew what he wanted to do. He had his vision. His aim was true. But he was not without his stumbles in this time. And I think it's kind of an interesting moment in his life.
Prince signed with Warner Brothers in 1977. He was 18 years old at the time, and he had found a manager easily while creating his demo at Moonsound. Owen Husney set up meetings with Columbia, A&M, and Warner Brothers, and within a week, all three were competing to sign this 18-year-old wunderkind. Through Owen's negotiation and the sheer strength of Prince as kind of an entity, his songwriting and his musical ability, he was offered an unprecedented deal with Warner Brothers for three albums. Usually, new artists got one or two albums, and got to maintain control over production. In the signing lunch with the Warner Brothers executives, rather than making a speech, Prince pressed play on a song he had written and recorded just for that occasion, called I Hope We Work It Out. You just heard that song at the opening of this episode. This song contained lyrics like, making music naturally, me and WB, music for the young and old, music bound to be gold. Kind of a not accurate portent for what was to come for Prince and old WB. As soon as he was signed, he got to work on For You, his first album, crafting it by himself. He recorded all instruments, did all vocals, and took total control of production. Warner Brothers had sent in Tommy Vaccari, a well-known producer who'd worked with Gino Vannelli and Carlos Santana, but Prince simply shrugged off any advice from him that wasn't already what Prince wanted, and would literally roll his eyes whenever Vaccari would approach the mixing board. For You ended up using the entire $171,000 that Warner Brothers had set aside for his entire three-album deal, and took months longer than they had planned to complete it. And in the end, only topped out at number 192 on the Billboard. Listening to the album now, you hear little moments of what's to come, but for the most part, it felt like Prince wanted to create the most rigorous, technically proficient, commercially slick album that he possibly could, by himself. It almost feels a bit airless at times, which is rare for something produced in the 70s, but it was also a huge learning experience for Prince. He absorbed everything through the process, from production techniques to a wide variety of synthesizers, notably the Oberheim, which he used to create the brass section on several tracks, and which would characterize the sound of a lot of his early work. Prince originally had a completely different configuration of songs in mind for For You, including a cover of Send in the Clowns by Stephen Sondheim. But the three songs that were both in the final album and his original vision were his a cappella title track, For You, the single, Soft and Wet, which Warner Brothers gave away waterbeds in a somewhat strange sweepstakes to promote, and Baby. After For You was released, Prince set about creating his band for his live show. Prince had his vision. He insisted on being marketed not as an R&B artist or a black artist, but as a new kind of genre-blending pop star. He assembled his band purposefully with this in mind. He wanted what he called a rainbow band, black and white, male and female. Musicians that looked like the blended and culturally fluid sound Prince was creating with his music. The first lineup was his friend Andre Anderson, or Simone, if you're funky, on bass. Bobby Z on drums, who Prince had been working with for a while at that point. Matt Fink, also known as Dr. Fink, on keyboards, who was a friend of Bobby Z's, had heard a tape of Prince via Bobby Z and had told Bobby Z, call me if this guy ever needs a keyboardist. Prince had an open casting call for other members through which he found Des Dickerson for guitar, Des Dickerson said he was the only guitarist at the tryouts who didn't grandstand. And Gail Chapman on keyboards. He started rehearsing at Dell's Tire Mart, which was a local garage owned by Bonnie Raitt's brother Steve, until their equipment was stolen. Then they moved to the basement of this local music scene patriarch named Pepe Willie, who Prince had actually recorded with quite a bit when he was in high school. As a band, their first show, played together, was at Minneapolis's Capri Theater on January 5th, 1979. Prince was a very tentative performer and often sang with his back to the audience. Only 2 days later, his second show ever with this lineup of people, Warner Brothers sent some executives to show up and watch the show and decide if he was ready for a full tour. Prince was very upset about this. He was feeling the pressure. And so, of course, it was at that show that Des Dickerson's brand new wireless pickup malfunctioned and picked up police scanner noise. Here's Bobby Z on the early shows.
The shows were monumental for several reasons, as, of course, the first shows Prince played live as a solo artist, this band's debut, and the debut of a lot of technology, wireless technology, that caused a tremendous amount of radio frequency to come through the guitars, which in hindsight is kind of humorous, but at the time, when you're hearing police calls and fire calls and radio frequency coming through the speakers while you're trying to play and perform, was not so funny at that time.
This obviously interrupted the show's flow, to put it lightly. And poor Prince, he's 19, painfully shy, not versed at stage banter. Apparently, he did try to address the crowd, and when he did, he could barely speak above a whisper. Warner Brothers said no to the tour. At this moment, after all this inertia has been thrown behind Prince and he's been kind of realized, things were not looking great. He had used up his entire 3-album budget on his first album, which had underperformed. He wasn't ready to play live shows. And on top of it, he had just fired his previous manager, Owen Husney. To solve the management problem, Warner Brothers opted for a large Hollywood management firm called Covolo and Ruffalo, who had worked with bands like Earth, Wind, Fire and Weather Report. They hoped that access to an entire team of runners and a manager just for Prince, Steve Fargnoli, would work more with Prince's style and level of demands that he generally placed on his manager. At this point, Prince threw himself into creating and recording new music for his self-titled second album, Prince. He again worked alone, and this time Warner Brothers didn't waste anyone's time and money with an executive producer. The only credit not to Prince on the liner notes for the album Prince is to Andre Simone and Bobby Z as heaven-sent helpers. Prince played all the instruments, did all the writing and all the production, and most of the vocals, but Andre did contribute some backing vocals. Unlike For You, which took 6 months to record and produce, Prince, the album, was completed in a matter of weeks. It seems like Prince was eager to iterate and get another round in and bounce back from his first album. He got a huge confidence boost by releasing the single, I Want to Be Your Lover, 3 months in advance of its release, and it shot straight up to number 11 on the Billboard Top 100. The album itself was released in October of 1979 and ended up selling 3 million copies. There are lots of very, very good songs, classic Prince songs on this album that even casual listeners have probably heard on the radio. Overall, the album feels much more diverse sound-wise than For You and just a lot more loose and fun. Prince seems to have learned from For You that how professional an album is not an indicator of how much songs will resonate with people, and rather seems to have dialed into a more pop writing technique, but across multiple genres. The songwriting has way more hooks, and overall the songs feel like they only have what they need and didn't have that overripe feeling that For You got into. There are R&B grooves, straight up pop songs, some middle of the road rock, and ballads. Here's Bambi, which is a somewhat generic rock song with extremely not generic, extremely envelope pushing lyrics. It was time to tour. He was invited to open for Rick James in early 1980.
1980 Fire It Up Tour with Rick James and the Stone City Band. And special guest, Prince. Come and see it.
He kind of beat the pants off Rick James while not wearing any pants himself. Haha, see what I did. But in Rick James' words, I felt sorry for him, he later recalled. Here's this little dude wearing high heels, standing there in a trench coat. Then at the end of the set, he'd take off his trench coat and he'd be wearing little girls' bloomers. The guys in the audience would boo him to death. There are also reports from James and his band that Prince borrowed, stole, ripped off, whatever you want to call it, large parts of Rick James' live show. But this comment, this memory, could be laced with some envy. The fact is that Rick James asked Prince to join him on the tour because, yes, Prince was talented. But also, Prince appealed to a wider demographic than Rick James. Prince was being marketed towards young white women. According to Des Dickerson, Prince's energetic and colorful opener was kicking the ass of the bloated two-hour headline show, with many audience members leaving early in Rick James's act. Rick James and Prince actually have a somewhat storied rivalry, which began with this tour. But we'll leave that for another episode. Right now, though, I want to play the set list from these very first Prince shows. So this is what you would have heard if you had been at, say, the Paradise Club in Boston on February 17th, 1980, or the Stanley Theater in Pittsburgh. on March 1st.
Thank you. Still waiting, you're up.
There was one last song that Prince and his band were gradually working into the set list at these shows. A new song that would appear on his next album, the album called Dirty Mind. Now, in Prince's first two albums, Prince's lyrics definitely leaned towards the sexual, and he had dabbled in more taboo topics with Bambi and Soft and Wet. But Head was a new level, and it was representative of the new direction that Dirty Mind would go in. And not everyone was into it. His female keyboardist, Gail Chapman, ended up quitting because she was so uncomfortable with Prince's requirement of kissing him suggestively during live performances of the song. As Des Dickerson put it, there had been some tension between her beliefs and what she was being called upon to do in our live show, Dickerson recalled. There was a developing role that she was given that involved the simulation of some pretty vulgar things on stage. The beliefs he's referring to is an evangelical Christian sect known as the Way International that Gail was involved in. But the kind of control Prince was trying to exercise over her was far more than the other members of the band. The other men in the band were encouraged to find their own personas and costumes. Matt Fink talks about how for a while he wore a jailbird costume until settling in on the doctor persona. Gail, on the other hand, was given a pile of multicolored underwear and told, "Here, wear this or Prince says you're fired." Gail has said, after the fact, that she left due to a feeling of lack of growth. Regardless of religion, I can understand wanting to escape what I think anyone would call a toxic work environment.
Might I remind you that you are listening to A Thunder Perfect Mood? I am your host, Marie Moon. Thank you for listening tonight to Prince's awkward in-between years. Let's call it 1977 to early 1980. Those times where he knew what he had, but he wasn't 100% sure how it was going to pan out. If you would like to get in touch, I'm on Twitter. Good old Twitter.com. You can find me on there as Marie Moon WMFO. I put old episodes up on our website, thunderperfectmood.com. Since this whole Prince deep dive situation is a true labor of love, I will again be rerunning this episode next week. But we will return on July 8th with a new episode. Something about Prince, I bet. This was A Thunder Perfect Mood on WMFO Medford. Be well. Good night.
Never have met you. We don't go way back. Maybe we wouldn't even be friends if we did. But when you wear a mask, you have my respect. Because your mask doesn't protect you. It protects me. I wear my mask to protect you. Mask up, America.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.